Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. The spotlight this morning again shines on Army brass after President Trump tapped Lieutenant General H.R. McMaster to be his national security advisor. Activity of military leaders in the political sphere is a question I asked retired Army General Martin Dempsey, former chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, when we talked earlier this month. Dempsey's coming to Baltimore today for the Baltimore Speaker Series presented by Stevenson University. During his 41 years in the military, he commanded cavalry and tank units and the U.S. Central Command. He served in both Operation Desert Storm and Operation Iraqi Freedom. In the year and a half since he retired, Dempsey's been awarded the Ellis Island Medal of Honor, been named an honorary knight of the British Empire, and been elected chairman of USA Basketball. Last summer, after retired generals spoke at both the Republican and Democratic Party conventions, Dempsey said quite emphatically that even retired officers should stay out of politics. That's where I started our conversation. I asked him why.
Well, first I was careful to single out generals and admirals in particular, because a general and an admiral, by virtue of serving for 30-plus years, I had 41 years, they begin to own not just the institution, but the professional ethos that defines it. And I had actually spoken about this frequently while on active duty, and so speaking in retirement as a retired officer to retired officers felt to me to be both appropriate and timely. And here's why. The military has a responsibility to be nonpartisan. Notice I didn't say apolitical, because we all have, you know, we should actually all have our particular beliefs about what's best for the country, and we should certainly cast our vote when the opportunity presents itself. But we should not try to influence those votes nor advocate those elected officials on the basis of national security, because it clouds the relationship between the military and the public. The public expect us to be nonpartisan. And secondly, one of my principles in retirement is to never make my successor's job any harder than it already is. And were I or the generals and admirals to whom I was intending this letter, you know, if we're chattering in the bleachers at those who are still in the fight and still on the in the arena, then it will confuse things and it'll generate suspicion among our elected officials about whether they can trust those who are currently serving or simply expect them to get out and begin chattering as well. So it was also very pragmatic.
In the letter that you wrote to the Defense One site, part of what you said is, quote, "In the political world, trust is generally derived from party loyalty. In the interchange between civil and military, trust is derived from party neutrality."
End That's quote. Correct.
So are you concerned about so many retired generals serving in President Trump's cabinet?
No, actually. I mean, you know, the advocacy for an election campaign is one thing. Once the president is elected, he or she can choose who to bring around them as their trusted advisors. And the military officers that he has chosen have great experiences, and they've all, at one point in time, they've all worked for me. I will say it will take some work for the military officers themselves, the retired military officers, to ensure that they act the part of civilian appointees and not act the part of military officers, because we have military officers currently serving who are responsible to give advice to the president and the Congress of the United States. So it's incumbent on them to make sure they stay in their lane, the lane to which they've been appointed, Director of Homeland Security, Secretary of Defense, National Security Advisor. And provided they do that and don't begin to give military advice, I think it'll be fine.
Already before you retired in September of 2015, you pointed to migrants, the millions displaced by war, and called it, quote, "a real crisis," close quote. Mm-hmm. And it seems only to have grown worse since then. How does the situation look to you now that you're no longer commanding troops?
It looked very dire to me then. It looks to me dire now. There's, I think the UN estimates 60 million displaced persons and refugees in the Middle East and North Africa. That means that family units are broken. It means education is broken. It means the health care for those people are broken. And it means that they are susceptible to groups that would seize upon their suffering using perversions of religion to try to comfort them, but also then to galvanize them. It's a generational problem. And the reason I say it continues to look dire is, you know, we see evidence that some nations are taking responsibility for them to try to help them. But the underlying issues, the issues that exist in the failed states and nations where they originated from, those issues remain pretty much about the same. And I think until the underlying issues are resolved, this will be a persistent problem.
But a year and a half ago, you said the world did not seem as concerned about the millions of people displaced by war as it had two decades earlier during the war in former Yugoslavia.
The Balkans, right.
Do you still see a downward slide in concern and attention?
You know, as a citizen and as a human being, it did feel like to me then, and it continues to feel like, that we've become kind of immune to suffering. As I mentioned in that previous interview, the world came together in the mid-1990s in the Balkans because of a mortar attack in Sarajevo that killed, as I remember, 47 or 50 people. Now, you know, we have children washing up ashore in southern Europe. We have vivid evidence and posted on social media and 24/7 news cycle, demonstrating some of the suffering that's ongoing. And I think it may be almost overwhelming. And I don't know, you know, again, I'm not an expert on how to break that cycle, but it's a cycle we all should be aware of and concerned about.
But let me press you, because you do obviously
yeah.
think about this. You say you don't know quite how to break the cycle, but what is on your mind that we should be doing about this massive suffering and displaced people migrants?
I do think that we should make a long-term commitment to the Middle East and North Africa. In other words, you know, we shouldn't renegotiate with ourselves annually, every year, the force levels that we're committing to the Middle East and North Africa, the budget that we're committing to the Middle East and North Africa, which is the source of most of these displaced persons and refugees. If we can determine, I'm talking about us now unilaterally, if we can determine what effort can we sustain over time, how many ships, how many aircraft, how many men, and not just military, but also the other agencies of government that within which the military can integrate to kind of have a, let's call it a collaborative effort to be part of the solution. Then, once we have identified our level of effort and a commitment to sustain it over time, then I think we're on a little more solid ground to engage nations in the region and our NATO allies, who are actually suffering most of the spillover effects because of their proximity. And so we have to lead an effort to form international coalitions that will commit to a long-term effort at some, you know, predictable level of effort in order to resolve these underlying issues. If we don't do that, then we're kind of dealing with, you know, one issue, one country, one group at a time. And that doesn't seem to me to be a path to success.
That's retired Army Four-Star General Martin Dempsey, former chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, top military advisor to the president, here on The Record on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. He's speaking tonight in the Baltimore Speaker Series, presented by Stevenson University. 3 months ago, you were elected chair of USA Basketball, the national governing body of men's and women's hoops. Congratulations.
Thank you.
What is your take on athletes protesting the national anthem at sporting events?
Well, you know, not unique to athletes, but I think any protest of the national anthem misses the larger point of the national anthem. I often challenge even young men and women here at universities as I speak to them. I ask them, how often do they hear the national anthem? And, of course, the answer to that is very infrequently and almost exclusively at sporting events. And so my particular advice on this issue is that, you know, there's plenty of opportunities for us to reflect on the things that tend to define our differences and pull us apart, and very, very few opportunities for us to reflect on the things that should pull us together. And, for example, the freedoms we enjoy and the values for which we stand as a nation. We're not perfect. And, you know, the national anthem, while we're standing respectfully listening to the national anthem, we shouldn't be convincing ourselves that there's not places where we could do better. But I, I, I do think that when we miss the opportunity for about 90 seconds, you know, maybe once every 2 weeks during the national anthem to think about what we stand for, we're missing an opportunity that is very fleeting. You know, here's another way to think about it. As you may know, I'm a student of literature, and William Butler Yeats, the poet, the Irish poet, said once that talent perceives difference, the differences among us. Genius perceives unity. I think we need some genius in the world that we face today. That is to say, we need to think about, you know, finding unity. We need to think about finding the things that pull us together and find a way to enhance and improve those and spend a little less time simply identifying our differences.
Before I let you go, let me pick up on your point about literature. You hold 3 master's degrees, 2 in military and security topics, and 1, your first master's, in English literature. What good does it do an Army general to do advanced studies in literature?
It's not for everyone. I mean, some people are passionate about history. Some people are passionate about STEM subjects, and I just happen to have a passion for literature. What I found that it did for me, or does for me, really, is it allows me to you know, kind of live vicariously through the experiences of others and understand different cultures and actually to find metaphors to help make sense of things in, you know, in dealing with some of the very complex issues that we face today. When I got to Iraq, one of the first things that one of my Iraqi counterparts told me was that I really should try to find a way to read some Iraqi poetry if we really wanted to understand the issues confronting the Iraqi society and their culture. And it proved to be good advice. So I do think, you know, you can learn a lot about not what civilizations, let's say, die or fade away of, but rather how they live. And I think that's a very healthy thing to do in the world in which we live.
General Dempsey, thank you for talking to us.
My pleasure. And we'll see you soon.
See you soon. Retired General Martin Dempsey, former chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, top military advisor to the President and Secretary of Defense. He's speaking tonight at the Meyerhoff Hall in the Baltimore Speaker Series presented by Stevenson University. I'm Sheila Cast. After a quick break on the record, our next episode of More Than Words, insights into the life of a gender nonconforming teen. First, a little known fact. General Dempsey has a terrific singing voice. Here he is singing his rendition of Frank Sinatra's My Kind of Town in 2012. I'm Sheila Cast, right back.
My kind of town Chicago is. It's got razzmatazz, and it has all.